Welcome to Theories of Reality. I'm Jabbar Odell, and what are we doing today? We're finishing out the Meaning of Life, and then we're going to review for the exam. So you've evolved from the muck and the slime, from the bacteria and the little creepy things with feelers, and the paramecium and the amoeba, and then the anemone, and then all the reptiles and snakes and the insects and all those things leading up to reptiles and birds and mammals and hominids, and you get the great apes, and then you get this branch off called Homo sapiens, and you get Homo sapiens sapiens, and lo and behold, there you are, and you're wondering, like, how did I get here? Oh, and eventually, you know, Darwin comes along, and then, you know, sort of later on, theories about the emergence of biology. And the answer is, well, a bunch of chemicals floating around the ancient atmosphere, some clouds of gas rubbing together, and a random strike of lightning, and there is the protein chains. One glorious accident. Okay, and again, where does all end? The grave. So then what are you going to do? And Tolstoy talks about, if you're like a scientific materialist, how are you going to live your life? You think, well, there's no reason why I'm here. There's no reason for living. I'm just sort of this random happenstance of the universe. And someday my molecules and atoms will all sort of come apart and decompose, and that will be the end of me. All my hopes and dreams and along with the fears will all be annihilated, and that will be the end of me. And so his Asian fable is sort of analogous to looking forward to old age and death. So there's really nothing you can do about death. It's sort of gnawing away at you every day. You get, you know, what was it? That is a Pink Floyd song, shorter of breath and one day closer to death. Every day you wake up another day closer to death. And you start to get old and creaky, and you get arthritis in your joints, and life isn't as fun as it used to be, and then you sort of settle into old age, and you're in your rocking chair with your cardigan, and pretty soon it's like a big one, or you get the cancer, you know, or something horrible happens. I had a good friend of mine, his father had non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. So it's like a really virulent form of blood cancer. It's a cancer of the white blood cell. And when you get that, it's pretty much, you're a goner. And so they just sort of try to make you comfortable. And, you know, it's not a pleasant death. And so you think about what you have to look forward to. Cancer, heart disease, you know, a respirator, lots of surgeries, hospital stays. Or, you could be, maybe Alzheimer's, you could have your mind go slowly. Maybe if you're lucky, you get taken out by a fatal car accident. A drunk driver plows into you, and it's a quick death. But anyway, the whole time you're thinking, time is running out. It's going to be the end of me someday. And it kind of gnaws at you. You think, well, what's the point? If life happened for no reason and ends in death, what does it all mean? And I guess the answer is, nothing, right? It's a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. And so Tolstoy sort of goes out looking for meaning, and he's done it all. He thinks, when he's a young man, he wants to sow some wild oats, and so he, cohabits with a bunch of young ladies, and he likes to go out gambling, and he kind of plays up the fact that he was like a bad person, but I don't know how seriously to take that. He got a bar fight and might have, like, hurt somebody or something, but I mean, it wasn't like he was like a sort of professional criminal or on the most wanted list or something. He was probably, if you look at the intelligentsia of the time, probably not much worse than anybody else. And then he sort of settles down. He's like, okay, it's going to be my family. I have a bunch of children, and I'm going to be a workaday Joe and come home and see my family and my wife. And then, the wife is sort of turned into like a kind of a harpy and was always after him for this and that. She's mostly interested in his money. And when he wanted to, like, give away the copyrights in his books, she, like, got really angry with him. He spent a lot of time away from home. And then So he thinks, okay, literary fame. If I become like a famous author, that's going to really fulfill me. And so he writes, you know, War and Peace and Anna Karenina and all these, you know, books that are still read today. Still, Dr. Zhivago and are considered great works of literature. And he gets very wealthy from these too. His wife convinced him not to give away the patents, and so he's like making all this money. And so he's really made it. He's achieved. And then you know, this sort of idea of artistic achievement, that you know, living for art. A lot of people have that idea, even if there's not a lot of money, even if you go unrecognized. The idea of struggle and, you know, to create something meaningful, that's sort of seen as giving meaning. And none of these things fulfilled him. And he talks about, you know, he could eat, could sleep. And he becomes eventually, he's suicidal. He's like, my life has no meaning. I want to kill myself. It's funny that you get people like this that typically like end up with great achievements. You look at famous, you know, rock stars and billionaires like Howard Hughes and Marilyn Monroe and who else you can think of. People that sort of they had it all and they end up committing suicide or they get hooked on drugs. Elvis Presley, he's sort of always thinking about whether his mama ever approved of him. And so you have all these people sort of self-destructing. And you think, you look at the person and you're like, hey, that person can buy anything they want. They have all these women that want to have sex with him, and or men, in the case of Marilyn, right? There are all some women, you know. Marilyn sort of swung both ways. And so you have all the things that most people say, well, what would I want? Well, as much money as Croesus. I would want, you know, like a huge amount of money where I can buy anything I want. Well, what else would you want? Well, I know, like a bunch of really attractive members of my the opposite sex or my chosen sex, whatever it is, you know, they all want to have sex with me, right? A bunch of groupies, okay? And what else would you want? Well, you know, I like to have the groupies, but I also want to be a family man. So I'll have the groupies and the family man. Maybe I'll do the groupies first, then I'll do the family thing. And I want, like, everybody, when I, like, walk into a room, they're like, oh, are you the great, you know, so fill in the blank with your name, right? Can I have your autograph? You know, I want people to like practically worship me. And why? Not just because I'm like Paris Hilton, who's like famous for being famous, but I really achieved something. I've created great art, and so I have a sense of personal pride and accomplishment. And you think, well, if you could do all those things, you know, you're Jimi Hendrix or person who's worthy of, you know, acclaim. But you could probably fill in your favorite idol. Ludwig von Mises, Joseph Schumpeter. Actually, to borrow an example from Bill Burroughs' class, he was talking about him. He's a famous Austrian economist, which is, you know, the only school of economics worth looking at. And so he said he had three goals in life: to become the world's greatest economist, and the second goal was to become the world's greatest horseman. And his third goal was to become the world's greatest lover. And he said, two out of three ain't bad. So, and he was actually known for being like not be able to sit on a horse for very long. He was a terrible horseman. So, you know, so I guess he went for, like, you know, the lover and the economist. And he was like one of the greatest economists there was. He's the guy that coined the term creative destruction. Talking about how the market sort of, you know, works in equilibrium, and if you have the people that make buggy whips, you know, get replaced by the people that make automobiles, and you don't want the government subsidizing buggy whips because that gets in the way of progress. So even though you feel sort of sorry for the buggy whip manufacturers, you know, they can do what one buggy whip manufacturer did, or they made buggies and they started making cars, and they can become General Motors. So you get, you know. You have to adapt or die, just like evolution. And anyway, so you think about, like, what would I want out of life? And I can think about, you know, travel the world, be famous, have lots of money, you know, great sex life, vibrant health, you know, all the things people want. And people that get all this, they're like, is that really all there is? And you look at the idle rich, and they end up, you know, killing themselves, or they end up with an alcohol problem, or, you know, look at the Hollywood movie stars, right? They're always, you know, hooked on cocaine, going into rehab yet again. And so this isn't like this is a modern phenomenon as well, that people who seem to have it all end up in this sort of existential crisis. They wonder what life they're meaning, what else there is, because they've had it all and there's nothing more. There's no other mountain to conquer. So what does Tolstoy do? Well, he delves into science. He looks at the writings of philosophers and sages, studies Buddhism, Islam, Christianity, and then he questions particular believers. So he doesn't just read the books. He goes and talks to Muslims and Buddhists and Christians of different kinds and says, tell me about your beliefs. What does it do for you? And he's kind of on this spiritual quest, trying to find out, what's it all about, Alfie? Do you have a question or are you stretching?
No, I'm sorry.
Okay. And then he says, he when he's out there looking, he says, all my rich, bastards of friends, they're always drunk on their ass, or they're in debt. They're trying to get more money out of their trust fund because they squandered it all, and they're just corrupt, and they're caught up in sort of surface things. They have no deep meaning to their life, and they seem to be completely miserable. Even though I have all these creature comforts, they're always bored. They have that the thing those fancy French words describe. What is it? Anomie, right? The sort of listlessness, directionlessness. What are those other fancy French words? I'm thinking there's one. There was a cartoon I saw the other day that was using one of these other fancy French words. Ennui is another one. This is sort of, again, the idea of anomie, I guess, means normlessness or lawlessness, where you're sort of directionless, I suppose would be probably the best translation. And then ennui is this sort of lazy despair where you feel tired all the time, and you can't motivate yourself to do anything. It doesn't seem like there's a point to anything. And so he sees this in the rich people, but the peasants, they wake up in the morning and they go about their business and they feed the chickens and they go out and plow the field or do their farmer stuff. And most of the people are farmers or they keep cattle. And so he's like, what's going on here? And so he concludes there's something about these peasants they got going for them. I stay with a family of peasants, and they have their simple life of hard work and something else that seems to work. And that something else for Tolstoy was a simple religious faith. So he says, you talk to a simple peasant, they don't know anything about theology. They just know, there's a heavenly father, and someday when I die, I'll go to be with him. In the meantime, my job is to work and take care of my family and to try to enjoy life. And God created the world for me to enjoy. And sometimes I don't understand why things happen the way they do, but I'm sure God's in control. And that sort of attitude seems to make people happy. And he compares this to sort of his friends, and he has this analogy of the handle. So that the handle, in this analogy, he says, suppose you're really, really hungry, and you walk into a tavern, and the tavern keeper says, eat your fill, have whatever you want on the house. You just have to go over there and crank that handle for a while. And you look over and you say, what's the handle for? And he's like, that's not for me to tell you. Just go crank the handle. And you say, well, I wonder, what's that handle for? Why should I crank that handle? Give me one good reason why I should crank that handle, right? Meanwhile, you're your stomach's growling. You haven't eaten in 2 days. And you're feeling kind of weak. And you're thinking, oh, that food smells really good. But by God, you're not going to put one morsel in your mouth until you find out what that handle's for and why they want you to crank the stupid handle. And he says that's the rich people. They're like, prove God exists. Why should I have faith? Why should I believe this nonsense? And in reality, if they would just sort of have that childlike faith that's talking about in the Bible, then they would have a happy life. And then, you know, even if they never knew that the reason in the example, the handle is used to pump water from a well. So they get water, you know, to cook and to drink. And so water is necessary for the thing people do in the kitchen. So what you got to do, you got to, like, go over there and crank the handle a bunch of times. Everyone does their part, and it brings water into the kitchen and makes it possible for them to feed all these people. Or maybe it's irrigation. I can't remember, but it's a handle to crank water. But you know, you're never told like what the handle's for, and you don't get the food until you actually crank the handle before knowing what it's for. And so that's his analogy with sort of the life of faith. That, you know, someday when you die, it's all going to be explained to you. But in the meantime, you have to take that step of faith. And so he concludes that meaning really is to be found in the faith of his childhood and the hope of eternal life, which is. He sort of where he started as a child. He talks about the faith of his childhood and how he sort of wanders away from it and goes on this long quest and it brings him all the way around, and finally he, you know, comes back to when he was 6 years old. You know, have a belief like a child, and to believe in God, have a simple faith, work hard, enjoy life, and, you know, don't try to over intellectualize things. Which is kind of interesting for a person who's sort of part of the intellectual class. I mean, Tolstoy is like a, you know, top-notch literary author and scholar and you know, a brilliant man. But he says, you know, all my brilliant intelligentsia friends, they're all like me. They want to kill themselves, or they're miserable, even though they have everything handed to them. That's maybe why they're miserable. And so that's what you need to do is just humble yourself, have that childlike faith, and then your life will be meaningful. Yeah.
Didn't this also happen to Friedrich Nietzsche? Didn't he kind of go a little crazy and stuff like that, because this whole thing, that without God and stuff like that, the whole concept of the meaning of life is kind of pointless?
Well, Nietzsche's kind of interesting in that he sort of delves whole hog into this, and he says, you know, there is no God.
Yeah.
And what does that mean? Well, it means we need to totally change our value system. But he saw that as sort of a positive thing.
Yeah, later in his life, he went a little...
Well, he did go crazy later in life, but it wasn't... it was because he had syphilis, probably. So it wasn't because he was like, oh, my life is meaningless. And so it was probably had a physical cause. He had some sort of brain disorder that made him go crazy. Because, I mean, for years and years, he's writing all this stuff about the will to power and about how there is no God and how we need to become gods ourselves and... et cetera, et cetera, and doesn't seem to have any psychological instability. It's only later in life when he starts getting kind of old, and maybe the little, you know, what do you call those things, the little things that end in sights, the lesions or whatever the syphilis does, it gets into your brain and starts eating away, and then he started going kind of nuts. And interestingly, too, that you know, he's all about the Ubermensch and the Superman and being strong and virile and smashing your enemies. And there he is, you know, being exploited. He's famous for saying life is exploitation. And at the end of his life, ironically, he's being exploited by his sister. She's like charging admission for people to come see, you know, the crazy Friedrich Nietzsche. Coming to you know, talk to him and see how crazy he is. So she's basically exploiting him. I guess that's it. So any comments or questions about Tolstoy? Objections? What do you think about Tolstoy versus Russell? Russell says you can be perfectly happy without God. As a matter of fact, God's probably going to like make you feel more miserable, because God tells you, oh, you shouldn't indulge in carnal pleasures. And it's like, what's one of the great things about, you know, being a human being? It's, you know, doing the old reproductive thing, right? Even though you don't want to reproduce, because then you have all these kids to take care of. But, like, you know, the whole, like, having sex is really fun. It feels really good. Well, you're an animal. You have animal instincts. Go out and indulge your instincts, Russell says. And, you know, I mean, Russell wasn't a total humanist, so he wrote this book, Marriage Without Morals. And he said, look, if you have a relationship with someone and you have an agreement and you say, this is the kind of relationship I want. I want a long-term commitment. I want a life partner. But I also like a little action on the side. And so, and you know, you're perfectly free to have a little action on the side too, and the two of us can have like sort of the benefits of marriage without having to resist temptation all the time. You know, and sometimes it's great to give in to temptation. Mm-hmm. And it's not really temptation. It's not like you're doing something wrong if you're not lying to the other person, if you're not sort of going behind their back. If you have an agreement and both parties are, you know, consenting adults, then Russell says there's no reason why you shouldn't be able to do the sort of have all the benefits of monogamy, but also have all the benefits of promiscuity, kind of put them together and have the best of both worlds, a long-term relationship and all that sort of fun hooking up recreational sex that you know, all you youngsters love so much. I had a student the other day telling me that he needs to get on Facebook. All his friends tell me that Facebook's where all the action is. And then he said, unless you're your age, people your age, they mostly like, you know, look at all the friends from high school and see how bald and fat they've gotten. but he said for the young people, you know, that's the way to do it. So what do you think about that? Or is that, you know, is that going to make you end up like Elvis or some permutation of that? You end up like with, you know, overdosing on cocaine or in rehab or, you know, with a string of broken relationships. Yeah.
I think that's good because then it makes it gives you the entitlement that you're responsible for your own lives, and then I think people will probably care more about what they do without being able to say, oh, well, I'll just ask for forgiveness later or I'll make up for it or something like that.
I mean, that's really like a kind of a test case, I suppose, for like the kind of almost, there's a few religions that let you have more than one wife. Ancient Judaism did, but women were sort of considered to be property. Mormonism had it for a while, and then the U.S. government said, we're going to call in the army to forcibly dissolve your marriages, and Utah is never going to be a state of the union unless you disavow polygamy.
And so, conveniently, God said to Mormons at that time that polygamy was done with.
Right, yeah, Brigham Young got a convenient revelation that the dispensation of polygamy is over. Even though the earlier he said, basically, if you don't have plural wives, God's going to send you to hell for not following the commandment to have more than one wife. But, you know, in Islam, you get up to four wives. But there's no religion that says, play the field as much as you want, right? They all have some restrictions on sexual activity. And so, to that extent, you're making some kind of a sacrifice, right? There's, you know, assuming there's, you know, I suppose I'm thinking about this Groucho Marx statement. I wouldn't want to be a member. I wouldn't want to join any club that would have me as a member. So sometimes you get that, right? You'd like, you know, a woman that would sleep with me, you know, would be a woman with such low standards that I wouldn't feel good about it, something like that. But you know, if you think about it, if you're young and eligible and you can find a person that you find attractive and they find you attractive, then you know, why not the life of pleasure? And this whole, you know, religion requires a lot of sacrifice and does he sort of romanticize living as a peasant farmer? Maybe the peasant farmers are just like, you know, they think they're happy because they're stupid, they're ignorant.
I don't even know if they're actually happy. I mean, I've never met a peasant per se, but based on what I know about their lives, I wouldn't think them to be happy per se.
Yeah, go ahead.
I just think that, like, it's too general of a statement. There could be as many peasants who are totally happy and satisfied and content with life to the town of peasants that are pissed that they're not the rich, intellectual, famous ones.
It also just says peasants. It doesn't really say. There's many different definitions of what a peasant is. I mean,
I'm just thinking about being sort of lower class. Like, for example, some of the happiest, longest-lived people in the world live in, like, Central America. You have lush tropical jungles. You have people engaging in subsistence farming. You have people that eat a simple, you know, simple diet of fresh, organic produce. And then what do? Like, you know, they spend time with their families, they talk to each other, and then they go down to the cantina in the evening, play a little guitar, maybe go out fishing for a while. And it's like that, you know, that that you think of that, that's sounds like a pretty good life. Whereas like in America, where we have all these, you know, technological devices and highly high material economy, it's like go. You know, instead of the sun, waking up in the morning with the sun or the rooster, it's like the alarm going, meh, 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 all the time to get up, you know, gotta go to work. And then you spend all this time working and you worry about, oh God, tax season's coming around the corner. And oh, it's finals week. Gotta get through school and get a job. I've been at Lane for 5 years. And, you know, you think, oh, I'm gonna get a job. The job market sucks. And, you know, oh, my girlfriend is like being all weird again. And you have all these things going on. Right. Whereas, like, if you're living in the countryside, it's like, what do? You wake up in the morning, stretch, go out and, you know, milk the cows and take the eggs from the chickens, and you smell the fresh air, right?
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
I've been reading, I also saw a production of Fahrenheit 451 by Ray Bradbury, and at the end of the novel, it sort of talks about he goes from his media saturated go culture to the sort of slower pace of life out in the country, and it sort of talks about how great it is. Well, I don't know. Some people find it really boring. I like talk to people that grew up in small towns, and they're like, I cannot wait to get out of that podunk town. And everybody's in everybody's business. And sometimes you get these people, they move like to a big metropolis like New York City, and they're like, I love New York City. It's like I can be completely anonymous. There's no gossip because, you know, everybody's a stranger. I pick my own friends. I like, you know, be able to go to like 20 restaurants within a block of my house. I like the hustle and bustle of the city. I like wake up in the morning, drinking my cup of joe, and, you know, seizing the day. So maybe, I mean, that's the sort of the flip side of it. That would be more. I don't know if that Russell would necessarily recommend that, but he would say that could be a completely fully fulfilling life, and you could be a goddamn atheist and be perfectly happy. Right? And maybe happier because you're not thinking, oh, you know, I probably shouldn't have done this, and I made that sin, and maybe I need to say a bunch of Hail Marys, and maybe I should like go to confession and be sorry for my sins, and I really shouldn't be thinking about that secretary, you know, the new hot secretary I got, even though I'm a single man, you know, it's out of wedlock sex would be wrong. We could go on a date, but I think I would be tempted. So you don't have any of those thoughts. It's like, you know, if there's an attractive woman, you say, you know, hey, how would you like to go out? And if she says yes, you're like, hot dog. And you're happy, right? And it's you don't have all this sort of, all these moralistic things that are all about what you should be doing, what you have to do, what God expects of you. It's all, you know, you and your goals and your life. Okay, so let's review for the exam. Actually, I don't need this on anymore. Get rid of some extraneous noise. And starting with the arguments for God's existence. Where are we starting here? Let me just think. We follow up with some new, actually. I'm sort of not 100% today. Got sick again, different kind of sick. I just got like a cold. Before I think I had food poisoning, which was most unpleasant. Or who knows. Something. That's pretty old. Rhinovirus, probably, which I think I can kick over the weekend, but feeling a little under the weather today. Trying to keep to myself.
When is the test?
So the test actually opens right after class. You can walk right over to the testing lab and take it right now.
When is it closed?
They're usually closed.
No, when is it?
Oh, I can't understand, you're mumbling. When does it close?
It closes at 5, and you need to be there before 4.
It actually closes at 7. At 7, Monday through Thursday, 5 o'clock Friday. But during final exam week, it's going to be 8 to 8, Monday through Thursday, and then 8 to 5 on Friday, or 8 to 5 on Thursday, closed Friday. So you have till Thursday at 5 to take it. But you know, it's open. You can take that exam right now if you so wish. So it's open now through next Thursday at 5. Anytime the testing lab's open. If you click on computer testing lab, you'll see the hours there in the middle. Why are they just giving me grief? Oops, that's why.
Yeah, so that's one day. We're not sure.
It's always easier. Error. No, I don't need to help me log in. Give me a second here. I have all this stuff set automatically in my laptop. Maybe I should go in with my connector like Mark Harris does. And all my settings.
The final is just over chapter 6 and 7.
That's why I'm looking to make sure what before I make a pronouncement. So if you click on final exam here, you won't be able to take it at home. But
Jeffrey,
yeah.
The projector's not on.
Oh. Guess I needed that after all. But if you do look under if you click on final exam, it gives you the dates it's open. Oh, it says right now it says Thursday at 6. That's not user error. That's Moodle resetting every date an hour ahead because it decided it needed to change all the dates when we went on Pacific Daylight Time or Daylight Savings Time. So it's actually Thursday at 5, and I'll change that today. And two people have already taken it. That's interesting. Oh, I guess I had this with me. Oh, it's 202. That's why two people have taken it. Let's go to 203. All right. I'm going to edit all this out of the recording. Okay, so, so it's in actually, I'm going to fix this so it's open right now. Got some old dates in here. All right, so it's going to cover the readings for weeks 8 through 10. I didn't say the chapters here. Packages. Sometimes I know what the topics are, but I don't know what the how I break it up. So weeks 8 through 10 is existence of God and meaning of life. And that's pretty much it, because this other stuff on free will was all on the second exam. It's all about God and meaning of life. Yeah.
Is there a way on the first two exams to go back and actually check like which ones we got wrong?
So you'll have to make an appointment to see me during my office hours, and we'll go over it like Brandon did earlier today, and we'll go over it on my big screen TV.
Okay. I didn't know. They had a lady at the computer lab. She was like, yeah, you can do it from home. You can check it from home on Moodle.
No. Only for the idealistic professors or professors that change their exams. Like they're completely different every time, or they don't care whether students pass long exams or have unfair advantages and so on. So certain instructors let you see the exam at home, and they don't care if you pass it on to your little brother or little sister or your pals or whatever, but I do care. That's why we have a testing lab in the first place. Because I'm not saying that you would cheat, but people in general, they will be tempted by it to cheat. So you'll just have to send me a Moodle message and set up a time to meet. If you got an A on the exam and you missed like 5 questions or something like that, I might be able to just like tell you really fast what the ones were that you missed. But if you want to look at it, you'll have to come by the office. My final exam office hours, I'll send out those out in the Moodle announcement in the announcements forum sometime tomorrow. I've been under the weather and didn't get any sleep last night, so I haven't got that done. But my office hours for next week may be different than my normal office hours. Okay. Arguments for God's existence. So we got 3 major ones, right? We have the ontological argument, the teleological argument and the design argument, or the ontological argument, the cosmological argument, and the teleological argument, also known as the design argument. And then we just have one argument against God's existence, which is the problem of evil. So, ontological, cosmological, teleological. The teleological argument, also known as the design argument. Telos means purpose or function. So it's the purpose or function argument for God's existence. And the problem of evil is our only argument against God. Although a pretty potent argument. Most of the exam on the God part is just going to be, what are the arguments pro and con? What are the strengths? What are the weaknesses of these arguments? And then the personalities. Who said what? Terms like the causal and contingency argument, those sorts of things. Anything that's bolded, any name is fair game for the exam. So let's just start off here. See, some other people are sick besides me. Never should have gotten that crowded elevator. Okay. So the ontological argument is an a priori argument. It's the only argument that we've had which is an a priori argument. An a priori argument is an argument which is about concepts. The opposite of a priori is a posteriori. An a posteriori argument is an argument that requires you to use your senses. So the ontological argument, since it's a priori, or you know, as the Brits say, a priori, an a priori argument just says, just think about concepts and how they're related to one another. Think just in terms of logic and what makes sense. And you'll see that this thing is either has to be true or this thing is impossible. And so the ontological argument says, think about the concept of God and think about the concept of existence. And then think about what it means to say God does not exist. And so you have Descartes' version. He says, God is a perfect being. That's just the definition of God. He's like this perfect being. Existence is a perfection, right? So a perfect being has to contain all the perfections there are, otherwise he wouldn't be perfect. He'd have a flaw. He'd be missing something. So he's got to have all the perfections. Existence is a perfection. It's better to exist than not. If God didn't exist, that'd be a pretty big flaw. Therefore, God exists. Simple. There you go. We can all go home now. We've proved God exists. Well, not so fast. So there's some criticism in this argument of Descartes' version. This concept of perfection seems sort of vague. What does it mean to be perfect? And to say that existence is a perfection, that it's more perfect to exist than not to exist. You know, it's hard to see what that even means when you talk about something being more perfect or less perfect. It seems like you're either talking about a value judgment that's maybe subjective for human beings. Like, my idea of the perfect day is going to be different than your idea of the perfect day. My idea of the perfect car is going to be different than your idea of the perfect car. So this idea of a perfect being, it's hard to even know what that means. Like, all the qualities that would make something more perfect than it otherwise would. It's kind of hard to wrap your mind around. So that's one criticism. Just the concept of perfection is sort of vague. It's hard to know what, and perfection doesn't really seem to come in degrees. Something's either perfect or it's not. And then the concept of perfection seems like it's subjective. And then it's talked about existence as a perfection. It sort of treats existence like a quality, like being brown or square, or being 100 years old. And that seems kind of weird too. And we'll get to this when we talk about Anselm's version of the argument. And generally speaking, all the I say most of the arguments that could be put against one will be put against the other, and most of the test questions will concern the Anselm's version. I'll just have you, like, you'll have to recognize the difference between Anselm's version and Descartes' version. So Anselm's version is not so straightforward. It's an indirect proof, whereas Descartes is just a simple logical syllogism. It's a direct proof. And this says, you know, it's like any other deductive argument. Socrates, all men are mortal. Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. Pretty simple. Anselm's argument says, if you can poke holes in atheism and show that atheism is not just false, but it leads to a contradiction or absurdity, then there's only one other alternative, namely theism. So what you need to do is show that the atheist, you know, is a fool. That he thinks he's talking about something that makes sense, but he's just spouting nonsense. And so first you got to start out with the definition of God. So Descartes says God's a perfect being. Anselm says that God is a being greater than which none can be conceived, or the greatest conceivable being. So when you think about all the different things that exist in the universe, and you think about the greatest of the greatest of the greatest, and there's going to be God at the top. Whatever is at the top of your imaginary chain of being, God is going to be at the top. He's the greatest being you can imagine in your mind. The greatest conceivable being. And so he says, now what the atheist says is that being is imaginary, that he only exists in your mind, not in reality. So the atheist is saying the greatest conceivable being exists only in your mind. But wait a minute. If he exists only in your mind, he's not really the greatest now, is he? You can think of a being which not only exists in your mind, but also exists in reality, which is greater. And then that being would be the greatest conceivable being. So therefore, the greatest conceivable being must exist. If he wasn't the greatest, then he... If he... For this, I'm trying to... I was doing really good there for a minute. If he didn't exist, he wouldn't be the greatest. Because an imaginary God is always going to be second banana to the real God. So God, the greatest conceivable being, must exist in reality as a matter of pure logic. Just by thinking about the concepts of, you know, the definition of God, concept of greatest, concept of being, existence. And you just think about how all the things are related and say, yeah, it's like saying God doesn't exist is like saying there's a square circle. It's like saying 2 and 2 is 5. It's just a contradiction. It's like saying it's both raining outside and it's not raining outside at the same time, the same place, in the same respect. That's a contradiction. To say that the greatest conceivable being exists only in your mind, the idea of greatest and only, they don't go together, right? Only is a limitation. Greatest says no limitation. It says it's the top, the ultimate. And so to the extent that you're saying it's only in your mind, it doesn't exist in reality, it's not really the greatest. So the greatest conceivable being must exist by definition. And one way of restating the argument is just that God exists by definition. And note that this doesn't require you to prove that a miracle happened, or that Jesus rose from the dead, or prophecy in the Bible was fulfilled, or the design of nature shows fitting of means to ends. You don't have to look out the world at all. You just close your eyes, you think about the concept of existing, concept of imagination, concept of greatest, and you kind of see the relations the same way you see a triangle is a three-sided figure, or if there's a mountain there has to be a valley, or that if you have a figure it has to be composed of one or more lines, right? It could be a curved line, it could be a straight line, but you can't have a figure without lines. In the same way, you can't have God without existence, according to this argument. Now, many criticisms of Anselm. This argument, by the way, is known as indirect proof or reductio ad absurdum. And it means in Latin to reduce to absurdity. And so what you're trying to do is show that there's only two choices. Your opponent's choice leads to a contradiction. So therefore, your choice must be the true one. And it's logically valid. If you can show that There's only two choices. There's no sort of third way. And that seems the case with, like, God exists, God doesn't exist, right? If you qualify what you mean by God, it seems like either there is such a being or there isn't such a being. And then if you can show that saying that there isn't such a being leads you to a logical contradiction, or, you know, logically entails a contradiction, then a contradiction can't be true, and God doesn't exist has to be false. If it's not the case that God doesn't exist, then God exists. It's, you know, it's like the double negative, right? If you think about this in terms of number theory, like the negative of negative one is one. Like if you take a negative one and you put a minus sign over the negative one, they cancel each other out and you get one. The same way, if you say it's not the case that God doesn't exist, that's the same as saying that God does exist. So, reductio ad absurdum, or indirect proof. So then, what are the arguments against that? Well, the big one, Ganillo says, that's a crazy argument, because I can take that same argument. I could prove that a mythical island exists. Suppose, you know, I say the greatest conceivable island exists, and you say, that's a crazy thought. I say, you deny that my island exists. But do you admit that, what you're saying when you deny that the perfect island exists is you're saying that the greatest conceivable island exists only in my mind, right? Yeah, okay. I think you're a nut, right? You have this crazy fantasy of, fantasy island or something. It's weird. And he says, aha, but when you deny my island's existence, you've proved it, because if it didn't exist, it wouldn't be the greatest now, would it? And you say, you got me. Or you say, what a stupid argument, right? that just, obviously, this island is just made up off the top of this person's head, and Ganillo is using this to show that Anselm's argument form has gone wrong. That if you can prove anything with this type of argument, that means that the argument doesn't work. Or if I can take the same argument form and I can prove something that's false with it, then that argument is an invalid argument. Because any valid argument, if it has true premises, it has to have true conclusion. And so Anselm's Ganillo is basically saying Anselm's argument is logically flawed because it proves all kinds of crazy things that we know aren't true. Okay, Anselm comes back. Oh, and his thing, he wrote his book's called On Behalf of the Fool. So Anselm starts out with this quote from the Psalms: "The fool has said in his heart, there is no God." And then Ganillo writes, "On behalf of the fool, let's hear the fool's side, the guy that doesn't believe in God." And even though Ganillo believes in God, he says, "Yeah, God exists, but, you know, believing through faith, not this cockamamie argument that doesn't work." They're both monks with a lot of time in their hands. So objections. The famous one from Kant is that existence isn't a property, or, you know, to use Kant's term, a necessary predicate. Kant likes using linguistic terms instead of metaphysical terms. But the basic idea is you think about a thing or an object, and its properties either exist or they don't. Existence isn't one of the properties. So if I describe, in the case of, you know, my car, actually, it's a 94 Champagne Toyota, so it's not a pea green. It does run well. But, you know, if I'm describing this automobile, and I say, you know, here are all the qualities of my automobile, 20 years old, automatic transmission, you know, so on, so on. And I say, well, I'll give it to you for $500. And you say, that sounds like a pretty good deal. It runs, and it's, you know, kind of ugly, but I can always repaint it. And I tell you, and you know, the best thing about it, it exists. You say, wait a minute. We wouldn't even be talking about this car if it didn't exist. You weren't going to sell me an imaginary car, would you? Well, that's the best feature, right? I think that even beats the 8-track tape player. It exists. You know, existing isn't the same thing as having an 8-track tape player. Having an 8-track tape player is a quality which describes the car. Existence isn't a quality that describes the car. And so either a car of this description exists or it doesn't. You can't smuggle existence into one of the qualities and then define an object into existence, which it seems that Anselm's trying to do. And so his point is that the whole concept of a necessary being, or a being that has existence as one of its essential properties, doesn't make any sense. And it's and there's something else here. Yeah, the thing is, properties together either exist or they don't together. And existence itself isn't a property. Oh, I know what I was going to say. Like, Kant makes this point that there's no difference in the concept of a real $100 and the concept of an imaginary $100. It's not like there's a concept of the real $100 and the concept of the imaginary $100. It's just that there's a concept of $100. And either that $100, a particular set of $100, either exists or doesn't, right? If I say the $100 in my pocket is burning a hole in it, and I'm going to have to, you know, buy some cocaine with it or pay a prostitute, right? Because I've got to get out of my wallet, right? I love spending money. Well, either there is $100 in my pocket, or you know, I'm telling a story and there isn't. But it's not like there's two concepts I'm talking about, the real $100 that might be in my pocket and the imaginary $100 that also might be in my pocket. Those aren't different concepts. There's only one concept, $100. The $100 in my pocket is the concept. And then either it's instantiated in the world, in which case it exists, or it's not represented or instantiated in the world, in which case it doesn't exist. Existence isn't a quality that belongs to the $100 in the same sense that, you know, being wrinkled and, speckled with white dust and, you know, having dead presidents on the bills is a quality of the bills. It's part of the concept of the bills. Existence isn't a part of the concept of the bills. Okay. The whole idea of the greatness and perfection are sort of vague concepts. You know, what's more perfect? A real pile of manure on your law, or an imaginary pile of manure on your law? I think I'd prefer the imaginary one. But maybe, you know, if you're like have an organic farm, maybe you like the free manure. So it seems kind of subjective. What counts as greatest seems like it's really a way of cheating and getting at subjective value. And so it's not really talking about objective properties, but it's talking about what people like. And what people would prefer, as opposed to what's better and what's worse. And then there's this third problem, which is if you can poke holes in the concept of God, you can show that God not only doesn't exist, but can exist. So this whole argument is assuming the concept of God is coherent. But there's all sorts of internal problems with the concept of God. God's supposed to be good, but God's supposed to have free will. Can God perform an evil act? Well, he never would, but the question is, could he? If he's omnipotent, then certainly he could commit an evil act. If he's good, he couldn't commit an evil act. So it seems like goodness and omnipotence might be contrary qualities. Do you have free will? If you have free will, then God can't know everything you're going to do in the future. Otherwise, it wouldn't be free. It would be predetermined. So it seems like that seems like a conflict with a belief that a lot of people have. Or you might say God's goodness and his omnipotence seems inconsistent with the evil we observe in the world. So you can go through, and then there's other problems with omniscience, and you can, like, if you read Atheism, the Case Against God, it gives you, like, a long list of all the internal inconsistencies that you can sort of pick out in the concept of God. The paradox of the stone is just one of them that I mentioned in the text. Now, Norman Malcolm has an interesting version of the ontological argument called the modal version, and it's based on possible worlds. And the idea is, if God's existence is possible, and just, you know, logically possible, if it's not contradictory, then it has to be actual. Because if God is a being who has existence as part of his essence, then if he exists in one possible world, he exists in all possible worlds. So all you have to show is that the concept of a necessary being is possible, and then you can show that proves that God exists. The problem is, you know, is the concept of a necessary being coherent? If it's not possible, then God not only doesn't exist, but can't exist. God's like a round square or a square circle or a contradiction being true or something. Any questions about the ontological argument? A ruler. Usually isn't. through here. The cosmological argument. So the cosmological argument is expressed in Aquinas' five ways, and it's the first three ways. So you might get a question like, the cosmological argument in Aquinas' five ways is which of the following? And you might get, you know, five answers, and you'd want to say, oh, it's the first three. It's the argument from motion, the argument from change, and the argument from possibility and necessity. So those first three. The second one's also called the argument from efficient cause. So you have the argument from motion, the argument from efficient cause, or just the causal argument, and then the argument from possibility and necessity. And what philosophers do is they take the argument from motion and the argument from efficient cause, and they kind of stick it together because, you know, what is motion? It's something that's, you know, being caused to move from point A to point B. What is change? It's, you know, efficient cause acting on an object. So the distinction between motion or change or cause and effect, most philosophers treat them as pretty much the same thing. So really you just have, they're boiled down into two arguments, the causal argument and contingency argument. So the causal argument is ways one and two, and the contingency argument is argument three, the one from possibility and necessity. And so, let's see. So the causal argument says, if God doesn't exist, where did the world come from? We notice in the world there's cause and effect. Some things create other things. A man creates his son. You know, sexist example from Aquinas, but sexist culture, medieval philosophy. A man, just as a man generates a son, he gives another example, the hand moves the stick, right? You get cause and effect. One thing, one event causes another event to happen. One thing creates another thing. And so there's two ways you can go on this when you talk about, well, is there a first cause? You could either say there isn't any first cause, there's just an infinite number of causes regressing to infinity with no first cause, with no first cause. But then that, he says, that's absurd to say that there's an infinite regress of causes. Because if there weren't a first cause, there wouldn't be any subsequent causes, and there wouldn't be anything in existence now. So you have to posit a first cause which created all the subsequent causes, and which explains the cause and effect we observe in the universe now. And everyone understands that to be God. God's the first cause or the prime mover. He's the one that got everything started. You know, in the beginning, God created. And then there's the contingency argument says that a universe of temporary things that don't have to exist doesn't make any sense. Because nothing lasts forever, so given infinite time, things would sort of peter out and die out and pass out of existence, and then there wouldn't be anything. But there clearly right now there is something. So contingent beings couldn't have been around forever. Therefore, there has to be a necessary being, which is the source of all existence. And that's what God is. And then he does the same thing. There could be an infinite regress of necessary beings, but that has the same problems with the causal argument. And so he says, you posit, you know, an ultimate necessary being, which is God. And so that's the causal and contingency argument. Criticisms, you know, it commits, the one criticism is it creates the causal argument. Let's take that first. It commits the composition fallacy. Just because every individual thing has to have a cause inside the universe doesn't mean the universe as a whole must have a cause. You can't say just because something's true of the part, it's true of the whole. It may be true that everything in the universe has a cause, but that doesn't mean the universe is a collection of things or the universe itself, the whole ball of wax, has a cause. It could have just always been here. So you can't take something that's true of the parts and necessarily apply it to the whole. And that's what Aquinas seems to do. Every student in this class has a brain. That doesn't mean the philosophy 203 class has, there's like a philosophy 203 brain. Right? So that's a logical fallacy. And then contrary arguments, you know, if there is a first cause, why call it God? Why does it have to be a personal being with consciousness and volition? Why couldn't it be some weird quantum physics thing? Why just one? Thomas Aquinas wants us to believe in like the monotheistic God of the Bible, but you could have like a bunch of different gods, like the, you know, Olympian gods or the Hindu gods or the Mormon gods. And so it's, you know, you, so you have, there's a problem there that you don't prove that there's the one Judeo-Christian God that got, that Aquinas wants to establish. And then you might try to argue that the infinite regress of causes isn't really absurd. Maybe just the fact that there are causes, there have always been causes, is sufficient. And then you might always say that the maybe the universe has just always been here. And that, I guess that kind of dovetails into the second argument here. Let's see. You ask the question, why is there something rather than nothing? Or where did all the causes come from? And maybe you say, well, no, there's no ultimate cause for everything. It's just that everything came from the thing before it. Is there anything necessarily logically fallacious about that? Maybe that is that any more incomprehensible than the idea of an infinite being who's uncreated and has always been here? Or if you want, you could say, well, maybe the self-existent uncreated being is the universe, and the universe has just always been here. Why say the universe had to be created by something else? Okay, then we come to the contingency argument. The contingency argument, Aquinas' third way, the argument from possibility and necessity, and there he says, if you look out at the world, there's a cycle of creation and destruction. Given infinite time, since nothing lasts forever, there would be nothing. But clearly there's something, therefore there has to be some necessary being, some ground of being that keeps everything else in existence. And that being is God. This has a lot of the same problems as the causal argument, composition fallacy. Just because every individual item in the world doesn't last forever, does that mean the whole collection of things doesn't last forever? Well, if you have more things being created than destroyed, or at least it's in equilibrium, you have as, like the conservation of mass and energy. As long as you have equal amounts of creation and destruction, you would always have the same amount of stuff in the universe. As long as for everything that's destroyed and other things created, there'd always be something, even given infinite time. Let's see. So that's the main argument. And then, you know, composition fallacy. And then maybe the problem is you can have, you know, maybe nothing is really created or destroyed. Maybe it just changes forms. And that seems consistent with the eternal universe. So, and then data from modern cosmology, you should know that the terms like the Big Bang, the Big Crunch, the Big Chill, open universe theory, closed universe theory. So the Big Bang is when all the matter that currently makes up the universe suddenly began expanding in an extremely rapid fashion. It was packed into a tiny little bits, you know, smaller than an atom, smaller than an electron, really, really tiny, packed really densely, and then it started expanding for some unknown reason. And the universe is continuing to expand at an ever faster rate. And it used to be the Big Bang theory was sort of fine with the steady state theory for a theory of cosmology. Now nobody believes the steady state theory. It's passé. So Big Bang theory is where it's at if you're a modern scientist. And it's really the only game in town. And so where is it all going to end? We know it all came from the singularity, from that little bit of matter that suddenly began expanding for unknown reasons about 14, 15, 16 billion years ago. Where is it all going to go? Well, you have three possibilities. You have the big chill or the heat death of the universe where things just keep on expanding. The universe runs out of energy. It kind of peters out and it dies, not with a bang, but with a whimper. and all the sort of the energy runs out of the universe and the molecules fall apart and you just get sort of homogeneous gray goo. And then the other thing that could happen is that so that in that case it's a momentum. Momentum is stronger than gravity. Momentum is going to push everything apart. The other thing that would happen is if there's enough stuff in the universe, gravity is going to cause it at a certain point to start collapsing in itself. In which case, everything goes back to that singularity, and it's like a cosmic trash compactor, the big crunch. And then another possibility is if there is a big crunch, there could be a big bang after the big crunch, some sort of metaphorical slingshot effect, where you get big bang, big crunch, big bang, big crunch, and the universe is oscillating like that over cycles of tens or hundreds of billions of years. And so that's a possibility, and that shows how you could have an eternal universe. It's Sagan's oscillating universe theory shows how you could have an eternal universe, which only looks like it's winding down. We're just looking at it on a down cycle, but after the down cycle, there's going to be another up cycle. We're seeing the expansion. There's going to be a contraction followed by another expansion. We're just looking at part of it, and we're thinking, well, there's creation, and who knows where it's going to go, and we're sort of in the middle here. How could this all, be something that's eternal? And Sagan says, well, maybe it's just you're looking at this little segment of expansion, and if you look at the whole thing, it's just this eternal cycle, sort of like a bellows, expanding, contracting. Let's see. Second law of thermodynamics. That is one of the reasons for the heat death of the universe, why the universe is running out of energy. So there is the conservation of mass and energy, but the second law of thermodynamics says in a closed system, things tend towards minimum enthalpy and maximum entropy, which is a fancy way of saying you run out of usable energy, and you end up just sort of stopping, and things get more and more chaotic, and you get even though you don't lose energy, there's a sort of concept of usable energy and usable heat, and it ends up basically you get a lot of energy that gets turned to mass. And then the energy that holds the particles of matter together all sort of dissipates too, and you get just like gobs of matter floating around. Okay, so that's a bit on cosmology. The design argument, or the teleological argument. This is another a posteriori argument. So the only a priori argument is the ontological argument. These other ones are a posteriori. They're based on the senses. The cosmological argument says, look at the universe, how did it get here? You have to use your senses to see, hey, there's cause and effect. Why does that happen? And then if you see that everything happens for a reason, and everything that exists was caused to come into existence by something else, then you say, well, where did the universe come from? It had to be caused to come into existence by something else. It's a argument based on what you observe. Same thing with the design argument. Paley says that every time you see order, complexity, and purpose, you think a mind must have created this. And he again compares the controversial stone to the stone to the watch. He says you pick up a pocket watch, you see it's got parts and it's fitting of means to ends, it's very complex, and you can clearly see it was designed by an intentional intelligence. You pick up the rock and you're like, well, how did this rock get here? Well, it was maybe part of a bigger rock and kind of cracked because of the temperature differences and broke off, and the rain came down and rounded it out, and kind of sort of looked like a face, but not really. And so that's different than the pocket watch. You would say, maybe these bits of metal sort of, came out of the ground, and then, a flood came and kind of jostled them around, and they turned into gears and springs, and just by coincidence, they sort of interlocked in certain ways, and over a very, 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 very long period of time, we get this wonderful pocket watch that says, to my Elizabeth with love, and has a nice picture of, the lovely young lady inside, right? And, how to get there? Well, there's there's pigments in flowers. Maybe a flower dies, a little splotch gets on there, and then maybe the rain kind of rubs it around, and the wind kind of blows some flowers around. But that's ridiculous. Nobody would believe that. So he says that you wouldn't believe the pocket watch exists by accident, or that random mechanical forces could produce a pocket watch. The height of technology of the 19th century. And you know, fine craftsmanship and intricate workings. Similarly, it would be ridiculous to think that the universe, which is much, much, much more complex than a pocket watch, could ever be created through just mechanical pushes and pulls and jostling and so on, blind mechanical forces. Arguments against it. There's Hume's counter analogy. So Hume says, well, maybe the world's like a vegetable. How do vegetables reproduce their order? It's through generation. Distracted by the 5 minute sign there. It's through vegetation. You know, they drop seeds. Pollination and germination. That's the word I was looking for the other day. Germination. So the seed sprouts. So pollination and germination. And so how would the tomato come from? Well, there was a tomato plant, and it dropped a tomato, and then it rotted, and those seeds got into the ground, and it grew another tomato plant. Order is transferred without anybody directing the whole charade, right? There's no person watching over tomatoes, making sure they reproduce. If you're a farmer, you can kind of plant the seeds yourself, but you know, there's plants out in nature, and nobody's gardening the wild plants. They just grow. Their order comes from the order of the plant before them. So maybe the universe was dropped like a seed. And then he says, well, what about animal procreation? You know, you might have some friends who were created by accident in the back seat of a Chevy. Right? There's no intentional plant planning there at all. There's no intelligent design. It was just like, oops, didn't mean for that to happen. I guess we're going to have to put off college for a while. And so where do you come from? Well, from two other animals that procreated. Well, maybe mommy and daddy universe got together and created baby universe. Now, it's a metaphor, right? So it's some interaction between two universes which creates a third. It's the watchmaker metaphor. There's not like a divine piton, a divine eye loop, and so a divine workbench or anything. So it's, you can't object to this by saying, well, it's crazy, you're talking about universes having sex. It's a metaphor. But Hume says that metaphor, that analogy, is as good as a watch. And then the final one is evolution. The evolution shows how random mechanical forces or a long period of time could have produced all the variety of life we see around us and all the fitting of means to ends. Just random mutation and natural selection. Once you get those protein chains and they get jostled around and become bacteria and then one-celled animals, you get cosmic rays, create a bunch of bad mutations, but every once in a while a good mutation. The animals that survive and procreate, there's more of them, and then they pass their advantageous traits on to their progeny, and you get the evolution of more and more evolved forms just through a simple blind trial and error process. That's why Dawkins calls evolution the blind watchmaker. So even though you could believe God designed evolution, God didn't have to design evolution. So if evolution works on its own without God, the design argument goes kaput. So even though you could believe in God and evolution, as many people do, you can't say there must be a God because how did all this wonderful stuff get here? Because the atheist can say, well, evolution. And he doesn't believe in God. He doesn't have to believe in God to believe in evolution. So that's why it's a significant challenge to the Zion argument. Meaning of life. Oh, problem of evil. That's an inconsistent triad. God is good. God is all-powerful, omnipotent, and evil exists. Can't believe all those three things. If God's good, he wants to prevent evil. If God's all-powerful, he'd be able to. But he doesn't. What's up with that? Well, either he's not good, he could prevent it, but he doesn't want to, or he could prevent it, but he wants to prevent it, but he can't. He's impotent. So, and then there's these three theodicies with attempts to explain explain why it is that God can be good and all powerful and evil can exist. It's, yeah.
What did you say that was called?
The Odyssey. Oh. The Odyssey. Not the Odyssey, but the T-H-E-O, like Theo, and D-I-C-Y, the Odyssey. And that's an attempt to try to explain the problem of evil. So a theodicy is an attempt to try to get God out of hot water by showing why he's doing the best he can, or why you should believe, you can still believe in God and believe that evil exists. And so you have the free will theodicy, the spiritual development theodicy, and then the human ignorance theodicy. That's the one you get in the book of Job. And I think that's all the time we have. I appreciate all the people who have contributed to our philosophical discussion and made excellent points. So, good luck on the final, and I'll maybe see you in a future term.
Thank you.
Thank you.